All right, well, good morning, everybody. We're going to get started on our Old Testament survey, a continuation here. So, Old Testament survey, so far, we've gone through the first five books of the Bible, right, the Pentateuch, and these books are also referred to as the books of the law because they contain the laws and instruction given by God through Moses to the people of Israel. So, as we head into the Promised Land this morning, we will cover Joshua, Judges, and the book of Ruth. So I thought it might be helpful to do a quick review in survey fashion to get a running start. If you haven't been here, just need to get caught up here. It's a good reminder for us of how we're doing to create this template of walking through the Old Testament, hopefully in what is a helpful way for you. So we started out with the book of Genesis. So if you have your timeline page, we got Genesis starting over here. So Genesis starting out, we referred to that as what? What was our main theme in Genesis? The book of, I heard it somewhere, beginnings, the book of beginnings, excellent. Written somewhere between the Exodus and Moses' death in 1146 to 1406 BC. And if you, and we spoke about Genesis, how we see God setting up certain institutions, for example, marriage and the family. And we talked about how these institutions were discussed to be formative and not performative, meaning God set them up, God gets to dictate how they are formed. We don't get to choose, we just need to obey in that. There are eight main points we covered in Genesis. Not to scare you, that sounds like a lot. But four events and four people. Anybody remember the four events? Started off with creation. Then we had the fall. Then went to the flood. And then the Tower of Babel. And the four people that we talked about. Obviously, there's more than four people in the book of Genesis. But kind of overarching here. We had Abraham. Then we see the Abrahamic covenant in Genesis 12. Land, seed, and blessing, that'll come into play today. Isaac, Jacob, and then Joseph. So from Genesis, which is our first marker in our Old Testament timeline, we move to the book of Exodus, which does progress the timeline. What was our overarching title for the book of Exodus? Deliverance, right? Salvation, deliverance. So here we see a population explosion happening. This might be hard for some churches to wrap their minds around, but I feel like here at Cornerstone, we think of that the nation of Israel went from 75 people to 2.5 million in roughly 275 years. We feel like, yeah, I can see that. That seems about right with all the kids we've been having. So we had three main points in Exodus, which were characterized by where the nation of Israel was at. So we had Israel in Egypt, looking at the birth of Moses, the calling of Moses, Moses and Pharaoh having a showdown, really God and Pharaoh having a showdown. We have Israel in the wilderness, the crossing of the Red Sea, Israelites fearing the Lord, learning how to do that, and then the wilderness. And then Israel at Mount Sinai. So Egypt, the wilderness, Mount Sinai, where they receive the Ten Commandments, further instructions and how to construct the tabernacle. So as always, as we make our way through this survey, we want to focus in on what the author's intent in writing these specific books were. Like we've been learning in our hermeneutics class on Sunday nights, we want to know what was said, why it was said, and finally, we must ask, so what? Like, what are we to do with this? So I thought it was helpful last week when Aaron added the application side of each of these books. So through the book of Exodus, we look at God grants deliverance, so we will rely on him more. We can relate with the Israelites, even though if we are in Christ, we have been set free from the bondage of sin. We still often trip up. We are too easy to forget as a people what God has done. So our next book, which does not progress the timeline, is the book of Leviticus. And what was our overarching theme for Leviticus? Instruction, right? Instruction. So Israel as a people group, they should be set apart, but how do they do this, right? They need instruction on how this is to function. So the two main points that we looked at here were how to ceremonially relate to God and how to relate to each other. These were important because they pointed to future realities and they displayed God's faithfulness and holiness, ultimately pointing us toward the new covenant. And the application side of that was God is holy, therefore we are to be holy. Our next book does progress the Old Testament timeline, and that is the book of Numbers. What was our overarching theme for Numbers? Wandering, right? In Numbers, we see the Israelites travel from Mount Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. We see chaos in the desert. We see the spies, the 12 spies sent into the land. Remember, 10 of the spies were bad, 2 of them were good. Those were Joshua and Caleb. That's important as we get into our lesson today. Those are main characters we'll see. In Numbers 14:30, it says, "Surely you shall not come into the land in which I swore to make you dwell, except for Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun." So there's a crisis of rebellion. They travel from Kadesh to the plains of Moab. Moses disobeys God by not speaking to the rock. He hit the rock. As Pastor John used to always say, if he would have just spoke to the rock, it would have brought forth Diet Coke. So I don't know if that's what you were hoping for, we brought forth. I always remember him saying that. So we see Aaron dies, and he's passing the priesthood down to his son, Eleazar. So our application from Numbers is unbelief is contagious. So specifically thinking on how are we leading, how are we directing our families. Then we came to the book of Deuteronomy, which means the second giving of the law. And that is a good description of what the book is. The previous generation was not going to make it out of the promised land because of their disobedience, and the new generation that was going to be raised up to take the promised land had to be trained in the law of God. What were they supposed to do? It was characterized by three speeches of Moses. There was a historical review, legal clarification for a new generation concerning civil and ceremonial laws, and then third was God's rewards and consequences. So finally, we see the torch being passed from Moses to Joshua. Deuteronomy is not a book that progresses the Old Testament timeline. So as we head into the book of Joshua this morning, the timeline will once again progress. So if we're following, we got Genesis, Exodus, under that is Leviticus. We have Numbers, under that time period is Deuteronomy. Then we'll go Joshua, Judges, and then under Judges will be the book of Ruth. So if you're filling out that form, following along, Joshua progresses, Judges progresses, Ruth will be that little box under the time frame of Judges. So the book of Joshua is most likely written between 1405 BC and 1385 BC. Joshua has been traditionally credited with penning this book, with the exception at the very end where it has the account of his dying, which could have been written by somebody very close to him, possibly Eleazar the high priest or Eleazar's son Phinehas. Our overarching title for this book would be Conquest. All right, so this morning, this kind of sounds like a movie blockbuster for the summer. We're going to have war, there's conquest, there's epic failure, and then there's going to be this beautiful love story. So get ready. It's going to be a roller coaster ride here. So Israel is now poised and ready to move into the promised land, land promised in the Abrahamic covenant from back in Genesis 12. Israel now has its worldview shaped. The nation is learning who God is. We see from Genesis, God is creator. We even see the promise of redemption in the proto-evangelium in Genesis 3:15. Israel has seen God as a deliverer, rescuing them out of the snare of the Egyptians, the book of Exodus. They have learned of God's holiness and how they relate to him and how they relate to each other. And they have learned how unbelief and disobedience has consequences as an entire generation met their end in the wandering. And we see the next generation trained up, poised, ready to enter into the promised land. All of this happening, we want to keep in mind, as God is moving forward his progressive redemptive plan. God continues to be faithful and leading. And so even though the leader of the nation of Israel has changed, we've seen Moses leading them thus far, in changing over to Joshua, we need to keep in mind that this is God's nation. Ultimately, the leadership is coming through God. So our outline of Joshua will be threefold. We'll see the conquest of Canaan. Actually, it's going to be twofold. Conquest of Canaan, and then we'll see the division of Canaan, meaning how we divide up the land. So as we do this, if you want to turn to the book of Joshua, I'm going to have some verses as we walk through this. You can kind of read through and see along the way with us when we get our eyes on the text. So chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, under the heading Conquest of Canaan. I'll give you a second to turn there. It says, "After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord said to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, 'Moses, my servant, is dead. Now, therefore, rise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, into the land that I am giving to them, to the people of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given to you just as I had promised to Moses.'" So we see Joshua now taking up the mantle. His command is simple: arise and go, you and all the people. Where are you going? Into the land that God has given them. And why should Joshua do this? Why should he have confidence that this will happen? We see in verse 5, "No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. Just as I was with Moses, so I will be with you," God is saying. "I will not leave you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall cause this people to inherit the land that I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, being careful to do according to all the law that Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may have good success wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your ways prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? This is very familiar. Be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened, and do not be dismayed. For the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. And so they go. And chapter 2 highlights the two spies that Joshua sent in to case out the land. I don't know if they sent two, because they sent 12 last time, and it cost them 40 years. So maybe they're wise, it doesn't say, but they just sent two this time to case out the land, especially Jericho. Here we meet an important figure in the harlot Rahab. Rahab gives us a glimpse into how the inhabitants of Canaan understood what it meant for Israel to show up on the border. This is Rahab's testimony, but it gives us insight as to what the people of this land were hearing and seeing with Israelite camping on their shores here. In chapter 2, verse 9, this is Rahab, and said to the men, I know that the Lord has given you the land, and that the fear of you has fallen upon us, and that all the inhabitants of the land melt away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you devoted to destruction. And as soon as we heard it, our hearts melted, and there was no spirit left in any man because of you. For the Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath. Rahab believed in God, and she protected the spies and secured her and her family's escape from the pending judgment coming upon Jericho. In chapter 3, we see Israel crossing over the Jordan River. Much like Moses leading the Israelites through the Red Sea, Joshua, now a form of a second Moses, as we'll see some instances, prepares to lead the people into the Promised Land. And once again, there's a body of water in the way that they must cross. In chapter 3, verse 5, it says, Then Joshua said to the people, Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. So Joshua is a great leader, a great commander, and a great worship leader. He is pointing the people to God. The Lord will do wonders among you. The God who was is the God who is. And God says in verse 7 that he will begin to magnify Joshua in the sight of all Israel this day. And why would he do this? So they might know that just as God was with Moses, God will be with Joshua. In verse 8, God instructs Joshua to send the Ark of the Covenant out ahead of the people. Once again, God is going out before his people. So we see God does the miraculous and stays the Jordan so the people can cross. The waters were dammed up 15 miles north of the crossing in a city called no less than Adam, right? Adam, A-D-A-M. So it's easy to remember that. It was dammed at Adam. So we see the people in chapter 4 making a monument to remind them just exactly of what God has done here. So chapter 4, verse 20. And those 12 stones which they took out of the Jordan, Joshua set up at Gilgal. And he said to the people of Israel, When your children ask their fathers in time to come, what do these stones mean? Then you shall let your children know, Israel passed over this Jordan on the dry ground. For the Lord your God dried up the waters of the Jordan for you until you passed over. And the Lord your God did to the Red Sea, which he dried up for us until we passed over, so that all the people of earth may know that the hand of the Lord is mighty, that you may fear the Lord your God forever. So now we learn later that Joshua is a brilliant military strategist, but he does what would be the unthinkable right after they cross the Jordan. Whereas they were protected by this natural barrier of a river that was flowing, most likely flowing outside of its banks at this time of year. Now they were firmly placed in the land of Canaan. They were amongst the hostiles. So what does this brilliant strategist do? He incapacitates his entire army by means of circumcision. So why? Why did he do this? Because God told him to. And we see this in chapter 5, verses 1 through 2. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 2. As soon as all the kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan to the west, and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea, heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the people of Israel until they had crossed over, their hearts melted, and there were no longer any spirit in them because of the people of Israel. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, make flint knives and circumcise the sons of Israel a second time. So think for a moment as though you were a Canaanite. You have heard of what God has done to the Egyptians already, and what the text says that their hearts had melted. Then think how much worse it was for them to hear of God doing it again, holding back the Jordan so that Israel could make their way in to invade them. God is making himself known through the miracle crossing of the Jordan and because of the people of Israel, a people that is consecrated, a people that is set apart to him. The fact that Joshua obeys and trusts God, what he is doing, it shows not only the nation of Israel that God is in control, but it shows the Canaanites that God is central to this nation. Israel is a people who is obedient to this great God. So here we see the people celebrate Passover, and on the very next day they get to enjoy some of the yield of the land, unleavened cakes and roasted grain. And verse 12 lets us know that the manna ceased on that day after they had eaten some of the produce of the land. So the days of eating manna are over. I imagine this would have been a very welcome change, right? We get all excited about a cheat day on our diet. How much more excitement would there be for roasted grain, right? Carbs in the promised land. So we experienced this a little bit. I painted for a couple summers in Little Rock, and every day we'd make this very generic little ham sandwich. So Monday through Thursday, we didn't really suffer. Our needs were met, but we had this boring sandwich, and we looked forward to Friday because that was fast food Friday. And so we'd hit Firehouse Subs, and what was a little tiny sandwich now became more than you should ever eat. So I imagine there was great excitement here for the people as they enjoyed produce from the land of promise. So at the close of chapter 5, Joshua has an encounter with the commander of the host of Yahweh, right? A pre-incarnate encounter with Christ, with his sword drawn in his hand, ready to secure a victory. This is what we see. Again, like with Moses, Joshua is told to remove his sandals because the place he was standing was holy. Chapter 6, the conquest begins, and we think on God conquering the land of Canaan. He does so in three campaigns. We have the central, the southern, and the northern campaign. God uses Israelite like a boxer, and hopefully the silly analogy will help you to remember how the attack went, right? He strikes a blow right to the midsection of the Canaanites, taking out Jericho and Ai. Then he stomps on their toe. That's the southern campaign, and then he gives them an uppercut to the north and takes out the stronghold of the northern Canaanites. So it's kind of silly, but it goes to the middle, southern, and then northern. Each of these campaigns will help us to focus in on and highlight something about God. So the central campaign, this is pretty easy, helps us to see that God is central. We see this in how even Israel is instructed to walk around the city of Jericho. We typically have this idea that they quietly marched around the city for the 6 days, and then on the seventh day it got real loud. But notice what is happening concerning the Ark of the Covenant in verse 8 of chapter 6. And just as Joshua had commanded the people, the seven priests bearing the seven trumpets of ram's horn before the Lord went forward, blowing the trumpets, with the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord following them. The armed men were walking before the priest, who were blowing the trumpets, and the rear guard was walking after the ark, while the trumpets blew continually. But Joshua commanded the people, you shall not shout or make your voice heard, neither shall any word go out of your mouth until the day I tell you to shout. Then you shall shout. So we see seven priests blowing seven trumpets of ram horns, also called shofar. I don't know if you've ever seen one of these horns or heard one of them. They're quite impressive and they're quite loud. And my father-in-law took a trip to Israel a couple years ago, and he brought a shofar back with him. And so we have this. It's about this long, kind of a spirally horn. And it's been a custom when we have our family gatherings to call in all the kids to eat with the shofar. So it's you almost have to plug your ears if you're in the house when this thing goes off because it's that loud. Sarah's brother-in-law played trumpet, so it's very similar. If you play trumpet, you can kind of play a shofar. It's the same sort of process. But it's loud. And there's seven of them going out with the ark, right, around the city. So the army was supposed to be quiet except for the seven priests, right, drawing attention to the Ark of the Covenant, blowing their horns as they circled Jericho. And this was to highlight, to show Jericho who they were up against exactly. Like flashing lights directing their attention, Jericho was not just going up against this massive army, which is true, but they were going to battle against the living God. Again, God is central in this campaign. Now we know this account. On the seventh day, they marched around Jericho seven times, and on the seventh trip around, priests blew the trumpets. Joshua told the people to shout. Why? Because the Lord had given them the city. And the way the walls fall points to even how God's sovereign in the way that the walls tumble down. In chapter 6, verse 20, so the people shouted and the trumpets were blown. As soon as the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted a great shout. And the wall fell down flat, so the people went up into the city, every man straight before him, and they captured the city. The LSB translates the way the wall fell down beneath itself. Right? It should have toppled into the city of Jericho, but it came down in such a way that it acted like a ramp for the military to just run up into the city, get the military high ground, and be able to take the city because Jericho was up on a hill. So if it would have fallen in, it would have been a barrier for them to get over. But the way even that the wall fell down shows that God is sovereign in this and helped them with the win. And so as the walls fall down, we see, as the Lord's directed, Jericho is a city that is devoted to destruction. Right? All that is in it belongs to the Lord. That's important because we see the Israelites fail in their very next campaign in the city of Ai. Because what God had commanded to be done in Jericho was violated. Right? We know that Achan stole the bacon. Right? Easy way to remember that. Not actual bacon, but he took a robe, 200 shekels of silver, and a bar of gold. What was to be set apart to the Lord, as was very clearly directed, he took for himself. He transgressed the covenant of the Lord, and Achan and his entire family was stoned and burned to death. In the very next verse, we see, as we enter into chapter 8, the Lord promises victory again. Right? Israelite is disheartened because they have had their first loss here, but the Lord promises to Joshua victory once again after they've dealt with the sin. So in chapter 8, verse 1, and the Lord said to Joshua, do not fear and do not be dismayed. Take all the fighting men with you. Arise, go to Ai. See, I have given you into the hand of the king of Ai. I'm sorry, I've given into your hand the king of Ai and his people, his city and his land. And you shall do to Ai and its king as you did to Jericho and its king. So central Canaan is conquered. God is fulfilling his land promise. In the southern campaign, this shows the depths of God's power. Chapter 9, we see the Gibeonites come to Israel, and Israel is deceived by these supposed travelers. They're in disguise. Israel does not consult God, and they make a covenant with the Gibeonites, something they were forbidden to do, make a covenant with the people within the land of Canaan. Now, Gibeon was strategically important because this was a main intersection, a main way of travel north and south and east and west. So Israel's sin makes it now impossible for them to conquer the promised land at this time. Israel has failed. They were to eradicate the wicked, evil inhabitants of the land. And there is good reason why they are commanded to do so. And we will see that as we progress into the book of Judges even more so. The southern Canaanites are mad at Gibeon, as you can imagine. Israel has come in. They've wiped out Jericho and Ai. And Gibeon makes a pact with them. They're going to be really frustrated. The southern kingdoms come against them. But Israel is faithful to the promise that they made to them. And they will go up and they will honor God by fighting them. Now, it seems odd that they're going to be honoring God by fighting with them because they disobeyed him in order to cause the fight in the first place. But they had made a pledge to them in the name of Yahweh. And so they are honoring their word. And so they're not using God's name in vain. In chapter 10, Israel honors God by coming to fight. This is after traveling a very long way from Gilgal west upwards to Gibeon. They should be exhausted, not ready to fight against the army that is five kings strong. And we see this is important because God is glorified through the weakness, through the tiredness. They've been hauling military equipment all the way over there. God is the one that is going to do the fighting here. And God will be glorified in this. God is firing hailstones from heaven and hitting only the enemy. I just love that imagery. Like, he's firing hailstones and they know exactly where the bad guys are and where the good guys are. And he's only hitting the bad guys. Like, God is sovereign. It's like a sovereign sniper in this episode here. But this is also where we see the sun stood still, showing that God's power is over all. They defeat the five kings and their armies, and next they head north, and here we will see the width and the breadth of God's power. In chapter 11, we see that northern Canaan is far better fortified than its southern counterparts. They had droves of horses and chariots. They had strong fortification. Yet this was no match for the Lord and his army. There's very little even to say about this massive battle. God very easily, decisively, powerfully, and quickly disposes of the northern Canaanite armies. See in chapter 7. So verse 7. So Joshua and all his warriors came suddenly against them by the waters of Merom and fell upon them. And the Lord gave them into the hand of Israel, who struck them and chased them as far as Great Sidon and Meseropeth and Maim, and eastward as far as the valley of Mizpah. And they struck them until they left none remaining. And Joshua did to them just as the Lord said to him. He hamstrung their horses, and he burned their chariots with fire. So now we will quickly move through our second point, which is the division of Canaan, the land being divided up. So God divides up the land to the tribes of Israel. There are three sections given out to the east side of the Jordan, like the Transjordan, to Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. The rest of the land is divided out from the west side of the Jordan and the Promised Land. One highlight is to remember back to those two spies that gave the good report from back in Numbers, Joshua and Caleb. We see Caleb is rewarded specifically in chapter 14 with the land of the Anakim, or the land of the giants, that he had not been afraid of. They went in there, and this is a land that's rewarded to Caleb. So we see God being faithful and rewarding Caleb's faithfulness to lead the people. God needs to continue his covenant with his people because the Israelites are unable to conquer all of the land. The plan is to be continued. God is faithful, but as we see, the people are not faithful in driving them out. The book comes to an end with Joshua reviewing Israel's history, and he pleads with the people, this is important, to put away the foreign gods which are in their midst and incline their hearts to Yahweh, the God of Israel. Then we see the record of Joshua's death at the very end of chapter 24. So our application from the book of Joshua is God is faithful to keep his promises, and we must keep God central and obey him if we are to honor him. That is the only way that our ways will be prosperous. So God is faithful to keep his promises. We must keep God central and obey him if we are to honor him. And that is the only way that our ways will be prosperous. So that's kind of rapid fire through the book of Judges, which is a big book. Now we will move to Judges, which again, that progresses the timeline. Our theme for the book of Judges is a cycle of sin. Or another way of saying that is Israel's failure. So the author of this book is not directly mentioned. We see through Jewish tradition it identifies Samuel as the most likely author, a key prophet, and we'll see later, that he himself is also a judge who lived at the times that these events took place and could have been there to write a summary of these events. The book of Judges covers quite a span of years from the death of Joshua in 1390 and precedes 332 years. So the time of the judges is 332 years. One of the things that we have to do when we come to the book of Judges is to address our understanding of the word. I was kind of joking with Seth earlier. We often say Joshua, Judges, Ruth. That's how we remember the order. But as we'll see here, it should be Joshua delivers Ruth if we think on the right terminology of what judge means. So who do you think of when you hear the word judge? What comes to mind? I heard Judy. Who said that? Somebody said Judy. Yeah. Anything else? What do judges do? They make judgments based on the law. Okay, good. And so we don't want to have Judge Judy in mind. That's my example as well. So you're right on cue. When we approach this book, a simple way to remember what we mean by judge is that term deliverers. You could just as easily and helpfully call the book of deliverers. So what is a deliverer in the context of judges? One who governs and leads, but is not a king, right? Everything is progressing towards a king, as we'll see in 1 Samuel, but it is not a king. A judge is not a king. They do not have the power to do what a king has the power to do. A judge does not have the ability to tax the people or to hold a standing army. A judge is a leader who makes military and peacetime governing decisions. A leader who comes on the scene for a particular purpose. So we must ask, what is that purpose? To deliver Israel from its oppressors, and there will be many that they encounter from within Canaan and from outside of Canaan during the period of the judges. So judges provide Israel with temporary leadership during a time of crisis. So temporary leadership during a time of crisis. We will see in the book of Judges 12 different characters that fulfill this role. Now the Bible lists out 14 judges in all. That includes Eli, the priest, and Samuel, the prophet. We'll see in 1 Samuel. Samuel was the very last judge, and most likely the author of this book. The period of the judges in Israel, we will see come to an end next week as we dive into 1 Samuel, as we'll see the installation of Saul as king over Israel. So remember that during this time period, Israel was operating as a theocracy, right? God was to be the ruler. Yet we will see this very telling phrase a couple of times throughout the book of Judges. It's listed in Judges 17:6. In those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So in those days, there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And it sounds a lot like what we read of in Romans 1, as to those who are given over to a depraved and a debased mind. And we'll see that as we go through this book. So we'll summarize this book into 2 points: failure to destroy the Canaanites and spiritual failure. A failure to destroy the Canaanites and spiritual failure. So this should sound familiar because we just walked through the book of Joshua where we see Joshua imploring the nation, like, you guys have got to finish the job. Joshua recounted Israel's history and what God had done, and he gave them a strong rebuke in Joshua 24, verses 19 through 23. Listen to what Joshua said. Joshua said to the people, "You are not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good." And the people said to Joshua, "No, but we will serve the Lord." Then Joshua said to the people, "You are a witness against yourself that you have chosen the Lord to serve him." And they said, "We are witnesses." And he said, "Then put away the foreign gods that are among you and incline your heart to the Lord, the God of Israel." So this starts off well in chapter 1. It's promising. We see the tribes of Judah and Simeon banding together to fight against the Canaanites. They had a victory in their battles, but very quickly in verse 27, we see Israel fails to complete the conquest of Canaan by failing to exterminate the Canaanites. So as if a rebuke from Joshua was not hard enough, in chapter 2 we see Israel being rebuked by the angel of the Lord. In Judges 2 verses 1 through 4, "Now the angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Boshim, and he said, 'I brought you up from Egypt, and I brought you into the land that I swore to give to your fathers. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land,'" right, which they failed to do. "'You shall break down their altars,'" again, which they failed to do. "'But you have not obeyed my voice. What is this that you have done? So now I say, I will not drive them out before you, but they shall become thorns in your side, and all their gods shall be a snare, like a trap to you.' As soon as the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the people of Israel, the people lifted up their voices and they wept." So our second point is tied very closely with the first point. The failure of Israel to destroy the Canaanites leads them exposed and leads them vulnerable to spiritual failure. Remember, the Canaanites were a wicked and abominable people. We see this talked about in chapter 2, verse 11. "And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals, and they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers." Remember, they just promised not to do this in Joshua. They're already doing this. "And they abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them and bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. They abandoned the Lord and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them over to plunderers who plundered them, and he sold them into the hand of their surrounding enemies, so they could no longer withstand their enemies. Wherever they marched out, the hand of the Lord was against them for harm, as the Lord had warned, and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were in terrible distress." And we see that the Lord raises up judges. "Then the Lord raises up judges who save them out of the hand of those who plundered them. Yet they did not listen to their judges, for they whored after other gods and bowed down to them. They soon turned aside from the way in which their fathers had walked, who had obeyed the commandments of the Lord, as they did not do so. Whenever the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge," so that's important, "and he saved them from the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who afflicted and oppressed them. But whenever the judge died, they turned back and were more corrupt than their fathers, going after other gods, serving them and bowing down to them. They did not drop any of their practices or their stubborn ways." So what we see here is this glaring cycle of sin in Israel. And what really stands out in the cycle of sin, besides what takes place 12 different times, is Israel's apostasy, right? In opposition to faith, when we think of faith, we think of what we are clinging to, right? Faith is what we are taking hold of. Apostasy is the opposite, letting go of it, which means that you are holding on to something. So Israel had tremendous exposure to the truth of who God was and what he had done for them, yet they, knowing the truth, they willingly turned their back on that truth. They turned their back on God. So this was willful. They let go. So let's take a moment to think through what we will call the cycle of judges, how this works. So we see Israel is in obedience. Israel's doing well. And then there's apostasy, right? They let go. They turn their back on God. Then we see oppression. So there's invasions from either the Canaanites themselves or outside forces, the Arameans or from Mesopotamia, the Moabites, the Philistines, the Midianites, and the Ammonites. So in this great oppression, Israel calls out to God. A judge is given. And this God is with this judge, and God is gracious. Israel is delivered from their oppressor. There's a time of peace. There's a time of obedience. And Israel is in back in the time of obedience. And then again, what do? They turn away from God. Oppressors come in. They cry out. God graciously grants them a deliverer. He drives out the people. And then Israel is restored to a time of peace and obedience. And this is what happens for 332 years. It's a very dark time. One thing that we need to keep in mind is that there most likely was some overlap to these judges as the oppressors sought to take advantage of Israel on many different fronts of these surrounding nations and armies. There are some judges that we get a lot of info on and some that we get very little on. So some standouts would have been Gideon and Samson. Just we have more information on them. There's some that are just very, very little information. But let's take a moment to look at these key figures just briefly as time is fleeting away here. So the first period, they kind of roll this into seven periods of time with the judges. Remember, there's 12 of them, but some of them are overlapping. So the first period of time was Othniel, and he took out the Mesopotamians through God, and that was in chapter 3. During the second period, we have Ehud and Shamgar, and they took on the Moabites, and we'll talk more about Moab as we get into the book of Ruth here shortly. In the third period, we see Deborah, so we have a female judge, and Barak was her commander. Barak was her military commander. And that also speaks to how depraved Israel is at this time. That's not speaking to the lack of Deborah's character or anything against her. It's speaking to the lack of leadership in Israel that God had to raise up a woman to take on and lead and help eradicate the Canaanites from this situation. Fourth period, we have Gideon, and he went against the Midianites. So Gideon went against Midian. Easy to remember. The fifth period was Tola and Jair. And they went against, the best way to put it is the after effects of Abimelech, who was Gideon's murderous son, who killed 70 brothers and got the nation wrapped up in a civil war. So they come on the scene right after Abimelech. And so it looks like they're trying to clean up that. It doesn't specifically have a lot of information about those guys, but it seems to be what they're doing. Sixth period, we have Jephthah, Ibzan, Elon, and Abdon. And they were against the Philistines and the Ammonites. And then finally, seventh, and arguably the most well-known, Samson. In chapter 13 through 16, Samson was against the Philistines. So if you have time, you can go through and read of the accounts of these judges. There's all sorts of things that are going on. It's pretty wild. It's pretty dark, to be honest. I was kind of depressed after reading this book. I was looking forward to the book of Ruth. But it just speaks to the depravity of what's going on in Israel. And it seems as though with each cycle of judges, Israel is spiraling more and more out of control, right? Like water heading down a drain. It's widespread and slow moving at first, and then it gets more aggressive as it descends down. Israel finds itself in chapter 20 in a civil war with its own tribe of Benjamin. So it's so bad. The civil wars, they're coming after the Benjamites, coming in on the heels of a horrific scene, a horrific grouping of evil acts in chapter 19, where we see a scene set up that's very reminiscent of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so as a result of what happened there, 400,000 men rose up from the nation of Israel against Benjamin as a result, and it almost wiped out the tribe. It was so bad, Israel swore against Benjamin, saying that cursed is he who gives a wife to Benjamin. So they're in ruins. There's only few men left. the depravity had become so great they can't take a wife from within the nation of Israel that they're told to go and kidnap the daughters of Shiloh just to maintain the tribe's existence. So there's this festival, the women are supposed to come out and dance, the young gals, and Benjamin is hiding in the bush essentially, waiting to go kidnap girls so they can continue their line. It's just dark. Things were not good in Israel. And we see in Psalm 106, this is a great summary of what's going on. This would have been a song that they sung to remember. Psalm 106, verses 43, I'm sorry, 34 through 46. Listen to how they would say it. They did not destroy the peoples as the Lord commanded them, but they mixed with the nations and learned to do as they did. They served their idols, which became a snare to them. They sacrificed their sons and their daughters to demons, right? Story of Molech. They poured out innocent blood, the blood of their sons and daughters whom they sacrificed to the idols of Canaan. And the land was polluted with blood. Thus they became unclean by their acts, and they played the whore in their deeds. Then the anger of the Lord was kindled against his people, and he abhorred his heritage. He gave them into the hand of the nations, so that those who hated them ruled over them. Their enemies oppressed them, and they were brought into subjection under their power. Many times he delivered them, but they were rebellious in their purposes and were brought low through their iniquity. Nevertheless, he looked upon their distress when he heard their cry. For their sake he remembered his covenant and relented according to the abundance of his steadfast love. That's just beautiful. Regardless of what they were doing, his steadfast love remains. He caused them to be pitied by all those who held them captive. So our application from the book of Judges, the consequences of sin are real and they are vast. And there is a real danger in leaning on our own understanding and thinking what is right in our own eyes is the way that we should go. We must always look to the way that God has set forth in his word. And our reframe is that there is a king. Not that there's no king. We have a king. And we are to follow King Jesus' ways. So the book of Judges in 10 minutes, right? So we will move on to Ruth. Ruth does not progress our timeline and would fall within the book of Judges as far as the time period. The author, again, is not identified, but again, Jewish tradition has assigned the text, like that of Judges, most likely to be Samuel. So our theme title for this book would be Redemption, mainly because of the aspect of a kinsman redeemer that we will look at shortly. The book of Ruth is a diamond in the rough. It is a bright spot among a season of terrible darkness for the nation of Israel. And as we have learned in previous studies, the light of the gospel shines brightest against the contrast of evil. And this is very evident as we look on the book of Ruth, set like a brilliant gemstone against the black backdrop of what we just learned in the Judges. So again, that analogy, you think of a young man going in to pick out an engagement ring. They bring out that black cloth and they set the diamond ring on top of it because that light shines the brightest against that dark black cloth. Ruth just shines like a gem against the backdrop of Judges. And working through it this week, it was a breath of fresh air to get to the book of Ruth, coming out of Judges and its depravity. So all the while, we need to remember that God is progressing his redemptive plan. Israel is still in a theocracy, but as we will see in this book, that the line of the great king, David, and ultimately the line of the King of Kings, Christ, will run through the line of Ruth. So we see right off in chapter 1 that this is taking place in the time of the judges. Verse 1 makes that claim, as well as stating that there is a famine in the land. So now we know there's a famine, there's oppression in the land. Most likely this was a time when Israel was being oppressed and needed a judge to be risen up to deal with that. Elimelech and his wife Naomi and their two sons head east out of Israel into the land of Moab, to the fields of Moab specifically, to look for food. They're hungry. They are traveling east to try to get food. Elimelech dies, and his two sons take Moabite women to be their wives, Orpah and Ruth. And sadly, we learn after that that both of the sons die, leaving Naomi with her two daughters-in-laws in a foreign land. So now we have three widows, and there Naomi's in a foreign land with her two daughters-in-laws. Chapter 1, verse 6 says, "Then she arose with her daughter-in-laws to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food." So it sounds like there was a deliverance, from the oppressors. Food was available again as a time of peace, and so they're going to head back to Judah, specifically to the town of Bethlehem, which is important as well. She implored her daughter-in-laws, like, hey, I have nothing for you. Return back to the house of your mother. Right? But she has no more sons to give them, is what she was referring to. But we see in verse 14 that Naomi is able to get Orpah to head home, but she can't shake Ruth. It says that Ruth clung to Naomi. This is a beautiful picture of her just holding on to Naomi. So our outline here will be four quick points. This time is fleeting. Ruth follows Naomi back to Israel. So we see her return to Israel with her mother-in-law. Ruth is faithful to Naomi. So through the events of chapter 1, we see that Naomi is bitter, and she basically tries to stiff-arm Ruth, keep her at arm's length. Despite Naomi's action, Ruth volunteers to care for her needs. So we see this character of Ruth, this humility of Ruth. Under the law, instructions are given from the book of Leviticus. The poor but able-bodied people are able to go and glean from the fields to meet their needs. So we see in the Lord's sovereign plan that not only does she end up in a field to meet her physical needs for food, she ends up in a field of Boaz, who is from the family of Elimelech. Point number 3, we have Ruth's claim upon Boaz. It's important to understand two customs in Israel when it comes to what Ruth and Naomi were facing. Both Naomi and Ruth lost their husbands. Without an heir from the line of Elimelech, there would be no way for Ruth and Naomi to hold on to the land of their inheritance. In the law, a man was to be a kinsman redeemer when it was necessary to buy back the inheritance of a poor relative or to build the family of a deceased relative. All right, no land in Israel could be sold into perpetuity. It couldn't be sold forever. This was because God did not want the land falling into the hands of a few or changing hands to another tribe. So at the year of Jubilee, every those 50 years, it would return to its original family. So we see Ruth going to Boaz under the instruction of Naomi to claim his protection because he was a near relative to Naomi. So Boaz notices Naomi in the field. He even goes and asks his main guy running the field, like, who is that? And the guy's like, that is a Moabite woman. Like, he's like disgusted with it. And we see that Boaz is excited. It's love at first gleaning, I guess, if we'll say that. So he asks more about it, and he says, hey, you know, Naomi, Ruth, you're not just going to glean from the edge of these fields like those who are poor and desolate. You're going to come behind my ladies who are right behind the guys who are scooping up the grain, and you can have the choice grain from this. And so we see Ruth gathering lots and lots of product, some barley and wheat to take back, and she gains favor again in Naomi's eyes. Naomi sees, oh my goodness, the Lord has blessed you through Boaz. So Boaz is caring for him. So we see Ruth going to Boaz at the instruction of Naomi to claim his protection, right? Because he is the nearest, well, we think nearest relative. But a problem arises because Boaz is not the nearest kinsman redeemer. There's one person that is closer. And so they have to go to the gates of the city where these interactions would take place. They'd gather elders from the city and have a legal conversation about what's going on. So Boaz, as an honorable man, he takes the necessary steps to go to the gate where these sort of issues are settled. Right? The relative with the first claim would not forfeit his inheritance. So this was brought forward to the man. It doesn't give us a name, but he will not forfeit his inheritance to take on Ruth and ultimately Naomi in the line of Elimelech. So he gave permission for Boaz to redeem Ruth and the line of Elimelech. So as chapter 4 comes to a close, we see why this account is so important as we see God progressing his plan of redemption. Boaz and Ruth ultimately are married. They give birth to a son, Obed, who was the father of Jesse. And we will see that Jesse is the father of David, who ultimately will become King David. So even amongst all the darkness and depravity of the period of the judges, there was a righteous remnant that God continued his plan through. It wasn't just all darkness. Ultimately, a selfless act by Boaz to forfeit his rights to redeem Ruth joined himself to the lineage of a future king of Israel, and ultimately, as we'll see later, the King of Kings in Jesus Christ. All right, so in the same way we see the Lord Jesus Christ bought us for himself out of the curse, out of our destitution, and he made his own beloved bride. He made us his own beloved bride. And we are blessed for all generations because of what he did. He is the true kinsman redeemer of all who call on him in faith. And we see this foreshadowing of a redeemer in the book of Ruth. We see what God is doing in the book of Ruth, and it directs us to what Christ ultimately has done on the cross. So that's kind of a quick flyover of Joshua, Judges, and Ruth. Remember that timeline? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, underneath Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Ruth. Now, we haven't filled in that little one under Genesis on your timeline. Aaron will get to that when we cover it. Hopefully that is helping to get a flow, and we always want to remember, it's easier. One of the commentaries I was listening to, the commentator said he asked of his Old Testament survey class, name as many characters as you can name in the Old Testament. And so he goes, I was impressed. They named 70 plus. He was laying them out. What was the one they forgot to name? God. It's easy for us to get caught up in reading these accounts. These are good. These are helpful. They are pointing us to God. They should point us to God and his character. As we see God's character shown to us, we see theology being developed, and ultimately we see the outflow of that, how we are to respond. So don't lose that as we think on all these characters, and they're vast, but we want to be thinking about what is God doing, this thread that he is pulling through the Old Testament.